In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. It is Monday, and that means Alan Adams joins us right here in studio for Pass the Popcorn. Good day, Mr. Adams.
And good day to you, sir.
Thank you, thank you. So you enjoyed our conversation with Henry Rollins?
I did. I was telling you off air. I had a VHS copy of Talking from the Box my junior year of high school. I watched so many times that the tape broke. I was a huge fan of his work with Rollins Band, which in turn sort of retroactively gatewayed me into his work with Black Flag. I was never a huge punk guy, but it's like, oh, well, if this guy is doing all this stuff, let's see what's up. And, I've obviously followed subsequently the career that he's put together is the sort of thing that, you know, that young Alan sort of aspired to, this sort of mix of, you know, he's a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
And he brings all of it, this wonderful, just sort of, aggressive intellectual curiosity, you know, which is it's a rare thing to see, like to see it in the wild. And it's just like he's just such an impressive dude. And by all accounts, like a genuinely good person.
Yeah.
Which is not necessarily, when you consider his background, it's not necessarily the direction you would expect someone to go. But just a genuinely good dude who just has very, very, who's very passionate about the things that matter to him. It was a great interview, man. So, yeah, well done.
And these shows that he does, they're marathons. Some of them will go 2.5-3 hours.
And it's just him, right?
Yeah.
It's just
telling stories.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. And it's... Like I said, just an iconic figure, an iconic pop cultural figure from my formative times. So,
well, a pretty big weekend at the movies. My goodness, better than even expected, and expectations were pretty high for box office, and it blew those expectations out of the water.
Well, it's one of those things where especially now, when they can say like never before at the American box office, like that's a big deal.
Yeah.
Because again, like we're all privy to the struggles that the movie theater industry is going through, all of which are certainly going to be exacerbated going forward by the ongoing writer's strike and the SAG after strike and all that. Because these people can't promote their work.
Right.
You know, unless they cross the picket line, and it does. And it seems that at least as of right now, they're holding pretty strong with a unified front, which is good. I think, I'm generally a pro-union guy anyway, but I think in this particular case, you know, obviously there are going to be people out there being like, oh, yeah, boo-hoo, rich people not getting as much money. And it's like, well, and you know as well as I do, because we've worked with these people. Like, the vast majority of working actors are doing their absolute best just to make a living. Like,
right.
These aren't people who, like, 99.9% of the people who are in these unions are not getting rich from their work.
Well, I think of a guy like our friend Eric Gratton.
Yeah.
Who we worked with, who, you know, Eric's an incredibly talented actor, but, you know, he'll have stretches where, you know, there's nothing for a while, and you wait and you wait and you wait. And yeah, you do 6-7 weeks somewhere, but you know, there's no insurance other than your union insurance. There's no guarantee that you're going to get a gig when this one is through.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it's just so funny how willing people are to cape for the billionaires. You see the same thing. You see the same thing in professional sports. It's the same. It's the same deal where I don't know if it's because the people who are, you know, producing the work are, you know, quote unquote, closer to us in terms of, you know, like, you know, we can't conceptualize being a billionaire, but we can conceptualize, oh, well, you know, I'd act for free, or right. I'd play football for free. And it's just like, that's not, it's a job, you know, and it's a job that provides a tremendous amount of value, for frankly unfair levels of compensation.
Yeah.
So, you know, hold out as long as you have to, guys, but here's hoping it gets turned around fast, because yeah, we're already seeing stuff getting pushed back for release dates and whatnot. So it's it looks like it could be kind of bleak this fall as far as like entertainment content. So enjoy it while you can, folks.
Yeah, well, so Barbenheimer weekend, two movies, and the overview, the headline is that you liked them both.
I did, and I did do the full Barbenheimer. I saw both films on Friday, with a very brief break in between. But yeah, it's like, you know, when you have two movies, one of which makes $80 plus million at the box office, and that's in second. Yeah. Like you've done well, but the amount of money that Barbie put, I think, surprised everybody, because I believe the last number I saw was $155 million for its opening weekend, which is like that's the biggest opening of the year.
Mm.
You know, and this is in a year that saw Top Gun, like this beat Top Gun Maverick, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
this movie, like, it beat like the Spider-Man movie, it beat it beat the Super Mario Brothers movie. Like, it really just absolutely demolished all box office expectations. And here's the thing, Rich, it's excellent. Like, it's not just a good movie, mm-hmm. It is an excellent movie. Rendered, frankly, not to get, I'll do a brief moment of Schadenfreude, but my enjoyment is only enhanced by the people that it's clearly making angry.
Oh, yes.
It's just like, oh, yeah, oh, Ben Shapiro's going to pitch a fit for 45 minutes about it. Like,
bonus.
Yeah, giddy up.
Yep.
Leaving aside the fact, and I'm sure you may have seen this on the socials, but like, he's literally dressed like the Kens in one of the sequences in the film. Like, it's just chef's kiss. You could not plan it any better. But yeah, Barbie, written and directed by the incredible Greta Gerwig, who is, I think, for my money, one of the most talented filmmakers of her generation. The truth is, if her name was like Gabe Gerwig, she'd probably be helming some sort of huge franchise at this point. She's had to work pretty hard to get where she gets. I think she benefits from her association with Noah Baumbach, but the truth is she keeps producing excellent work, and this movie is no exception. Now, is it weird that she's crafted this incredible movie built around a frankly problematic doll that's been around for 70 years? Yeah, it is weird. Doesn't change the fact that the movie's awesome. The basic plot, I'm not going to go too far into it, because honestly, I think you should just see it for yourself. And there are so many wonderful surprises in this movie. I would hate to take that away from anyone. But the basic gist is we are in like Barbie Land is a place that exists. There is a connection between Barbie Land and the real world that is never specifically defined, which I think is a wonderful choice, keeping things ambiguous. It's like there is definitely a connection, but we're not entirely clear what that is. But yes, we have Barbie, Margot Robbie, actually, whose full title is Stereotypical Barbie. and we just meet her as she is living her life in Barbie Land, in her big pink dream house with her pink convertible, all of her Barbie friends who are also named Barbie, but they have we see all the Barbies from the years of Mattel's production. You know, you get, you know, scientist Barbie and writer Barbie and president Barbie and newscaster Barbie, and just all these all the different jobs that Barbie has held over the years. Each one of those Barbies is represented by a different actress. A phenomenal collection of talent, by the way. Folks like Issa Rae is President Barbie, a really wonderful like running of the gamut of different ethnicities, different body types, like really very much sort of skewering the notion of Barbie as this as the unrealistic physical sort of object that so many sort of you know decried her as. But yeah, so she basically spends her days. She drives to the beach where she you know, and that's where we meet up with the Kens. and here's the thing about the Kens. There's no Dr. Ken. There's no writer Ken.
No.
They're all just Ken.
Just Ken.
Which is awesome. We have our primary Ken, played by Ryan Gosling, who is, like, it seems strange to say out loud, but I feel very confident that Ryan Gosling is going to get an Oscar nomination for his portrayal of Ken in this movie because he's so good. But he's far from alone. A wonderful collection of Kens. Simo Liu is excellent. Kingsley Benadier, and then of course we have Michael Cera as Alan, who delighted me for any number of reasons. Shared name aside, and it's basically just we get a glimpse of life in Barbie Land, where it's basically like the Barbies are you know living. You know, their best lives, and the Kens are sort of not sidelined, but just very content with their lot. We'll put it that way. Which, you know, a power structure that has women at the top, you can see how a certain element might be a little put out by that. And then we're juxtaposed with the real world, which is where Barbie has to go because, see, here's the thing. Stereotypical Barbie is partying, like, you know, she's doing the big choreographed dance number, and then in the middle she has I think it's fair to call it an existential crisis. It's a specific line that's spoken. I'm not gonna spoil it because, again, like, it comes out of nowhere and it's awesome, but you know, record scratch the whole thing. And then and that's when we learn about the existence of Weird Barbie, anyone who grew up around little girls knows that at a certain point, Barbie gets played with maybe a little too hard, and then you've got like the hair gets cut weird, there's like the drawing on the face, like all that stuff, and again, all Barbies are in Barbie Land, and so there is a Weird Barbie, and it's Kate McKinnon. And she is also excellent. Big surprise. But as it turns out, we discover that these Barbies have connections to the people who play with them in the real world. And so the best guess is Barbie's real person is dealing with some whatever. And so in an effort to fix things, Barbie decides she's going to go to the real world. She goes... she winds up with a stowaway. You could probably guess who it is, but I'm not going to say. Okay, it's Ken. It's Ryan Gosling's Ken. They wind up in the real world trying to figure out the situation. And that's when we meet the CEO of Mattel, played by Will Ferrell, it's a shockingly nuanced portrayal. The character is more complex than you think. And it's really wonderful. But the big takeaway is we meet a woman with a single mom, played by America Ferreira, who is struggling. These are the people that Barbie connects with. And so she has to figure out what comes next. Meanwhile, while she's doing this, Ken discovers patriarchy.
It's working pretty well for Ken, right?
You know, and it's like he's looking around and he's like, hold on a second. And as you might guess, that sort of information brought back to Barbie Land could potentially cause some problems. Ooh. We're going to leave it there because, again, I don't want to spoil anything too much. But this movie is so incredibly smart and so thoughtful. And so funny. Like, that's the thing. Like, there are so many, like, genuinely laugh out loud moments. Everything is working on multiple levels all the time. Like, I think different people expected different things going to see this movie. And most of them got what they were expecting, which is a really difficult trick to pull off. I will say there were some younger viewers in my screening, and there are a couple of jokes where it's like, okay, that's, but I mean, it's, it, I mean, it's right. It's PG-13, right. Like the rating's right there. Yep. Like they're not, it's not like it shouldn't come as a surprise that things are going to get maybe a little bit adult. Mm. But I mean, there's no language issues. There are a couple of like very, very thickly veiled innuendos that are also very hysterical. But the thing about this movie is they had to commit so fully to the bit for this to work.
Right.
If anyone is like, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, or anything like that, it's all going to fall flat. But everybody and Robbie and Gosling in particular are so invested and committed to the characters. They play it straight, you know, and, you know, they play it with innocence and naivete and, you know, and all that, but it's all coming from a very honest place. And when you do that, it informs the sort of satiric edge that we're looking for. It informs the sort of thoughtful commentary that we're going for, and it informs the frankly hysterical humor that's going on here. I've talked about my admiration for Gerwig. She's an incredible director. She's a wonderful screenwriter. Probably better at the latter than the former, but it's close. We should all be so good at something as Greta Gerwig's second best thing, whatever that is. But even across the board, like, the movie looks phenomenal. Like, the production design is top-notch, and they clearly went above and beyond to craft something that was very reminiscent of, that captured that sort of Barbie spirit. From, like, from the clothes to the... Barbie Land itself is just just this phantasmagoria of pink lunacy, and it's so fantastic. And then, you know, and then we get to the performers, and the cast is outstanding. Robbie and Gosling are just fantastic. Like, they're just like, Margot Robbie is one of those actresses who I think, you know, and it's like, oh, boo-hoo, but it's like, I think she's had to fight against her looks for a significant part of her Hollywood career. Just because I think it's, you know, I think it's true that very attractive people aren't necessarily taken as seriously, particularly women, which, again, Barbie, like, there's a lot to unpack here. But she's so wonderful in this role, and I don't know who else could do it. But then you venture into the supporting cast, and everybody gets a moment. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, just, and they all get it. Like, everybody understood the assignment, and they go hard, up to and including our narrator, Dame Helen Mirren, who's also fantastic and gets off one of the best jokes in the entire movie. Again, not going to spoil it, but yeah, it's outstanding. And then there's the music, which is just like banger after banger. A couple of original songs that are really excellent, including one sort of story song at the beginning, where the lyrics subtly change as you go through, and you start to wonder if everybody's really, if Barbie's okay. And then Gosling brings the house down with a song that's called Just Ken. And he sings it himself, which, kudos.
Yeah.
And it is just excellent. So yeah, like, I mean, top to bottom, front to back, this is an outstanding movie. It is funny. It is smart. It is challenging in the ways that you want good pop culture to be challenging. And I hope everyone who didn't see it this weekend gets a chance to go, because it really is worth your time.
That's awesome. All right, that's the first half of the big Daily Double. What about Oppenheimer?
Also awesome, Rich. Like, I mean, it was one of the best movie going days of my life in terms of sheer quality. of what I consumed. I mean, as you might imagine, very, very different movie-going experience. So, yeah. But again, and here we're talking about yet another wildly talented writer-director in Christopher Nolan, who has shown a real knack for, you know, finding these, you know, finding compelling ways to tell these, frankly, kind of bleak stories, and finding ways to sort of capture the, I don't know, the underlying truths behind some of these stories. And, you know, at first glance, it was like, oh, really? Christopher Nolan's going to do a biopic? That seems strange. And then it's like, oh, it's Oppenheimer. Okay. And then the more you think about it, and the more you sort of connect the, you know, connect the dots with his previous work, it's like, oh, yeah, this makes total sense. Like his, like Nolan's whole thing is this this idea of exploring the, I mean, just how horrible we can be to each other, you know, in so many different ways. And, you know, to tackle a person like J. Robert Oppenheimer, you know, who in many ways sort of, you know, he birthed the atomic age in so many ways, for better and for worse. And, you know, in that, you know, that sort of question, better or worse, is sort of centralized in certainly the latter half of this movie. You know, we get the let's see if we can. And then we get the, should we have done that? Like that sort of, it's, you know, it's very typically Nolan in that, I mean, as typical as Nolan gets, in that we have a sort of fractured timeline. Our framing device is essentially the confirmation hearing of Louis Strauss, who headed the Atomic Energy Commission, and then was, I believe it was Secretary of Commerce. He was at a Senate hearing, and you know, his relationship with Oppenheimer, who at that point had been discredited due to his ties to the Communist Party. It's the 50s, so that, you know, if you ever like were in the same room as a communist, they were ready to, right, you know, to throw you to the wolves. But we bounce back and forth in time from his, you know, we meet him when he's first at Cambridge, sort of developing, you know, his scientific ideas. We meet him, and then we're moving when he's, you know, getting hired to work at Princeton, where he, you know, where we encounter Albert Einstein, and then it's back to, you know, the recruitment for the Manhattan Project and the move out to Los Alamos, and then we get to see his relationships with women through two primary women in his life, played by Florence Pugh and Emily Blunt, both of whom are excellent, although, as is often the case in Nolan's films, and one of my primary issues with the guy, such as they are, female characters tend to get the you know, backseat a little bit, and that's similarly the case here, although both are excellent. Blunt in particular does a phenomenal job of sort of capturing what it must have been like to be, you know, the spouse of such a, you know, brilliant but also flawed kind of individual. And yeah, and we just move back and forth through these different times. We also spend some time in the sort of clearance renewal hearing that wound up being the centerpiece for you know, for Oppenheimer's disgrace. You know, that as it turns out, there are a lot of machinations going on in an effort to sort of undermine his place in sort of the public eye as a public intellectual, which was something that I think the powers that be weren't necessarily super interested in. And again, just moving back and forth up and down the timeline as we watch. And then, but again, the central story is, of course, the time spent at Los Alamos developing the atomic bomb. And it's funny. I will say some familiarity with the history would be helpful. Simply because it really is a cast of thousands, because there are so many people involved in this story,
right?
And it's like, you know, if you miss a name, or it's like you don't necessarily know who anyone is, because again, it's time and place. A lot of these guys look pretty similar, if you get my drift.
Yep.
So, but it's also a phenomenal cast. Like Cillian Murphy, is, I mean, he's an immense talent. I think he's someone who has maybe flown under the radar a little bit, certainly in this country. I know, you know, I'm not a Peaky Blinders watcher, but I know a lot of people who are, and he's apparently quite excellent on that show. But like, this is very much a coming out party for Cillian Murphy. He is amazing. He's amazing in this. Like, and he's done the physical transformation bit, which you know, I'm always iffy on that. But the truth is, he really does look like Oppenheimer. Like, that's the thing. And I think that I think sort of slimming down like he did, because Oppenheimer was such a skeletal kind of guy. Like, I mean, he basically subsisted on, you know, cigarettes and martinis. Like, that was his deal. So you know, so obviously he's going to be kind of a gaunt figure. But Murphy just captures this wonderful, like, sort of deep-seated conflict. Like, this, you know, you get that sense of scientific brilliance, but you also, you know, you're also given this understanding of his inability to kind of interact with the world around him in a normal way, just because, like, you know, his mind is sort of consumed by these larger questions, and so he's never quite right when he's, you know, doing interpersonal interaction, even when you're talking about like his close friends or his wife or what have you, his brother. But it's just, it's so compelling to watch. And some people have complained about the length, you know, and you know me, I'm not afraid to call out like when I feel like a movie is overstuffed. The truth is, you could have done another half hour with this.
Wow.
And it's already over 3 hours long, but there's just so much story to tell, especially when you're sort of, you know, running this gamut. But, you know, in terms of supporting cast, I mentioned Emily Blunt. I mentioned Florence Pugh Robert Downey Jr. as Strauss is phenomenal. Like, it's such a wonderful part for him because it's this great sort of, you know, because we all, you know, the last 15 years have given us the sort of finger snappy, like fast talking hipster Robert Downey Jr. that sort of, you know, who sort of sails on charisma. And in this part, he like allows that charisma to curdle a little bit. Like, it's still there, but there's something like sort of just a little off about it, which really works. But I mean, it's just like so many like prominent names in this film, people that you know. You know, Matt Damon is wonderful as the general who sort of brought together the Manhattan Project.
Is it Tom Conti plays Einstein?
Yeah.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Oh well, and it's just like, but it just goes on and on. Like, and like people show up, and you're just like, holy crap, they're in this too. Like, even if it's just for a few minutes. Josh Hartnett is in it. He's very good. Casey Affleck shows up for a hot second. Kenneth Branagh's in this movie.
Wow.
Like, just on and on. Like, I could just go through and just list the names of people, you know, who were in this movie. But that's the thing. It's like, everybody wants to work with Nolan. Like, it's, you know, he's got a reputation, for a reason. Like, you know, he doesn't make bad movies.
And isn't it great, I think, that you have these two huge movies getting very favorable reviews, huge box office, and neither one of them has a number after it.
Oh, it's so good, man. And like, if you want to make the argument Barbie's, you know, pre-existing intellectual property, fine. That's not the reason people went.
Right, right.
You know, it's not because, like, It's a Greta Gerwig movie about Barbie, and yes, you might get a little boost from the fact that people recognize, you know, and you've got this sort of extant icon, but man, you get in the seat and you start watching that movie and you're just like, holy cow, all right, this is what I'm talking about. And then you've got this super stylized, super dense, you know, 3-hour biopic about the father of the atomic bomb.
Light summer fare right there, huh?
And it does $80 million, yeah, Rich. Yeah. Like, it's just, like, that movie, I'm so thrilled at how well that movie did, because it deserves to do well. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think Oppenheimer is probably the primary beneficiary of the Barbenheimer effect.
Oh yes. Yes.
I don't think it's controversial to say that. But I think that it's really, really great that so many people got to see this movie and got to see, you know, a master of the craft doing what he does, bringing together an extremely important story in American history, and one that I don't know gets told as thoroughly as it probably should be. I feel like for me, like, I don't know, like, I don't even remember Oppenheimer in my history book, like maybe a sentence or two, like nothing really much beyond that,
right?
You know, and like, and the machinations behind the scenes, you know, his early days, like the, you know, his conflict with the powers that be, and them sort of weaponizing his past against him, you know, followed by the, you know, the subsequent, you know, sort of half-assed reputational rehabilitation that followed once everyone was like, oh man, that McCarthy guy was a real nutbag, huh? but, you know, just sort of seeing that story play out and just getting a sense of the scale of the hugeness of the endeavor that these people came together and basically lived in the desert for 3 years to pull off. Again, and you know, you have to enter into the idea that, you know, it's Nolan, so it looks fantastic. Like, they do a wonderful thing where we have interstitials that are designed to sort of indicate the massive destruction that comes from the bomb. But, you know, the framing device, the Senate hearing stuff, all in black and white. Wow. You know, so it's this really striking contrast. Mm. But yeah, okay, so look, Oppenheimer, it's not necessarily as easy a hang as Barbie, but it is an incredibly powerful and incredibly well-made and just an incredibly good film. So, I mean, Barbenheimer just like hit the ball out of the park, man. Like, we shall never see its like again.
See them together, see them separately, either way.
I am become Barbie, destroyer of worlds.
Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure.